so much for allowing us just to be here today. Thank you so much for John and for Jan just opening up their hearts and serving us and teaching us. And I pray that you would help us just to be able to take in what is taught today, and we can be able to pass it on to others. Lord, I pray that we'll be able to make your word clear and be able to defend what you have given to us. Thank you so much for allowing us just to be here today, Father.
Amen.
In Jesus' name, amen.
Yeah. All right, so this is our last class. If I go back to the beginning, we look at our outline. We got a zillion slides to go back to the beginning. So our outline was first to look at the evidence supporting the reliability of the New Testament text. Let me see, where is our, oh my goodness, too many slides to go back. I've been adding slides to the PowerPoint, if you notice, if you check it out online, I've been adding slides. Here we go. Okay, great. So, New Testament documents, New Testament canon, and the point of that is that the New Testament that we have, the Greek New Testament, is an almost perfectly version of the original, and the canon was selected by the early church fathers because of apostolic authority. Then we looked at Old Testament documents, and again we saw that because of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the gap of 1,500 years between when the books were written and the oldest copies was covered by 80% almost, and yet the evidence is very strong that the Hebrew text that we have is very reliable. I wouldn't say nearly perfect, but very reliable. And the conclusion from all that is that the New Testament that we have is the Greek and Hebrew New and Old Testament we have is has no significant difference in teaching, in theology, and points of fact from the original. Okay. And then what we did was we looked at extra-biblical sources. We looked at things that people might have thought of as being possibly competition, if you will, for the New Testament or for the Old Testament. For example, the Old Testament Apocrypha. And what we notice there is that if you look at the Old Testament Apocrypha, it kind of helps you to even realize what an inspired book looks like. And we saw Tobit and Judith, which are obviously fables, and we saw 2 Maccabees, which is not reliable history, and we saw Wisdom of Sirach and Ecclesiasticus, which, whether you think it's wise or not, is clearly in contradiction with things taught in the New Testament, all right, and in the Old Testament. And then we looked at competitors for the New Testament, and like the Gospel of Thomas, and you read stuff like that, and you just shake your head. People actually propose that there were more than four Gospels, and that was debated. It's really quite silly. Then we looked at the scriptures of other religions, and what I pointed out is many of the world's religions don't even have things that would even be called inspired. In fact, the only reason they defend them to be inspired probably is because Christians claim their scriptures are inspired. The Quran is the closest version of a religion that has texts which they would have claimed to be inspired even if it weren't for us. And yet, when we see the science errors, the fact that you had, that even Muhammad admitted he had to remove things, he had to change things, the doctrine of abrogation. And then we look at other scriptures and we realize the Bible absolutely is unique. There's really no comparison in any other world religion, not even close. Now we talked about inspiration and inerrancy. We spent most of our time on inerrancy. This course is not principally about proving the inspiration of the Bible, although we are going to have one section at the second half of today's class, just one aspect, I believe, that shows inspiration. But so basically, what we looked at is the Bible clearly claims this. And then a reasonable person has to ask, well, does the data agree with this claim of inspiration? And we talked about prophecy and miracles and all those things. Then we talked about inerrancy, and we found out that inerrancy needs to be defined fairly carefully if you want to have something that you can defend. Because the bottom line is, we have copies, not the originals. There are some mistakes in those copies. And besides, there are things that a Western mind might demand for inerrancy, which wouldn't apply in a Near Eastern way of thinking. For example, chronology may not have been an issue, rather thematic. Also, there are things said in the Bible that aren't true because some pagan person or some sinner says something. So you have to be a little bit careful in defining what you mean by inerrancy. We spent a lot of time on that. I don't want to go back through that now. But I think we would agree that certain things would be clear errors, such as if David didn't even live, or if he didn't actually kill Goliath, or if Jesus was not literally descended from David, or if the prophecies that David spoke were not fulfilled, or if the Bible made a clear and ambiguous statement of historical significance, which was in fact not true, or a clear and ambiguous scientific statement that was in fact not true. And I'm going to claim that none of those things are true. And therefore, a reasonable conclusion is that the Bible is inerrant. Okay? Now we have to talk about contradictions. So this is the biggest area of attack that I get at my website by far on the Bible, is to say that it's so full of contradictions, it can't possibly be inspired. And how could anybody even know how to interpret it? Okay? So the claim then is the Bible is full of obvious errors of fact and doctrine. And those errors of fact or doctrine are proved both by comparison to history, but also by comparison to the Bible itself. Like I said, probably ignoring this, pretending that it's not an issue, is not going to work. Now, I've already said that I give the Bible the benefit of the doubt, and I'm not going to pretend that I don't. In other words, when I hear about a supposed contradiction, a supposed theological unresolved question or something like that, I'm going to be honest with you. I assume that it's not true. And the reason I assume that, I use the analogy of my wife. I mean, if somebody gave me supposed evidence she was being unfaithful to me, I would dismiss it immediately because it's reasonable. It's reasonable to give the Bible the benefit of the doubt. But then again, when we with humans, we should give humans the benefit of the doubt as well. If you accuse somebody of contradicting themselves, they should be able to, the benefit of the doubt should be that unless you can prove it was a contradiction, that it was in fact not a contradiction. All right, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to have three categories of contradictions that people claim. Identical events described by two different authors having details that appear to be in conflict. This would be primarily, obviously, from the four Gospels, but there'll be things like in 1 Kings and in 2 Chronicles. There'll be things perhaps in Jeremiah and 2 Kings. And people will claim, and by the way, you like my joke there, no pets allowed. All pets must be on leash, yeah. Next, claims of a theology or a doctrine. In other words, that the Bible is inconsistent with itself in what it teaches about God or about the commandments it gives. It gives commandments that you can't obey them both, that kind of thing. And also just mistakes like in one place it'll say 5,000, another place it'll say 500. Can't be both. I mean, obviously that's a contradiction. Okay, we'll talk about all three of those. Now, these are questions to ask, and I think these are fair questions. Unfortunately, the critics of the Bible tend to not ask these questions because, in my opinion, I don't know, I don't want to judge somebody, but in my opinion, they're not interested in whether these contradictions are real. They're just throwing mud around. Which, of course, is not how we should act. But anyway, so the first question is this a legitimate contradiction? In other words, is there a perfectly reasonable explanation of the supposed contradiction that could be found simply by reading the relevant passage in context, giving the benefit of the doubt to biblical reliability? And by the way, like I said, I get a lot of this. I would say I've had probably 400, 500 questions on my website specifically regarding supposed contradictions. Most of them come from believers, by the way. They read it, they hear about it, and they're wondering. But a significant minority come from people who are just blah, blah, blah. You know, well, how could you believe that stuff? Okay, number two. Is there any chance that a scribal error could explain this. Is that a possibility? And we could ask, what kind of errors, you know, what kind of supposed contradictions could reasonably be explained as a scribal error, as opposed to being an ad hoc hypothesis? Remember, an ad hoc hypothesis is an explanation you give not because it's a natural explanation, but because you're trying to defend a particular belief that you already have. And we should not be using ad hoc explanations to defend the scriptures. If we are, that's evidence that really we don't actually believe it's true. All right. Number three, is it possible the two passages, rather than being contradictions of one another, actually complement one another? We'll see several examples of this. In other words, if you understood how they're both true, that would actually deepen your knowledge of the Bible rather than be evidence of a contradiction. So these are going to be typical responses to these claims that the Bible has contradictions. So we're going to look at contradictions of fact, supposedly, and we'll look at contradictions of doctrine, supposedly. And then we'll do some more contradictions of fact. And then we'll do some that are admittedly a little bit hard. Then we'll do a few more. And then we're going to, for fun, we're going to pick one and we're going to solve it as a class. Okay? So we're going to pick one. You get to pick. And then as a group, we'll kind of, you know, try to come up with a reasonable response. Because that's the goal, is for you to be able to respond to this yourself, not have to go to my website. Or besides, obviously, this class can't cover every supposed contradiction. By the way, there's a book called All the Contradictions in the Bible. It's like this thick. I read it. It's kind of boring. It's like after a while, it's like, seriously, do we need another one? Anyway, it's a book basically of somebody responding to all these claims. All right, so let's look at Genesis 7:17. Genesis 7:17. And here is an obvious contradiction, proving the Bible has multiple authors who should have had a little committee meeting together ahead of time so that they could claim it's inspired, because it's obviously not. Just kidding. Genesis 7:17, and it says, the deluge continued 40 days on the earth. All right? 40-day flood, right? Genesis 8:3. It says, the water steadily receded from the earth, and by the end of 150 days, the water decreased significantly. All right, so, let's go back to chapter 7, verse 23 and 24. He wiped out every living thing that was on the surface of the ground, from the mankind to livestock, to creatures that crawled, to the birds of the sky, and they were wiped off the earth. Only Noah was left, and those who were with him in the ark, and the water surged on the earth 150 days. So here the person says, help me out here. 40 days, 150 days. And I'm telling you, I get these. And from people who say, obviously, you know, nobody could believe the Bible, even that the writers of this account couldn't get it straight on whether it's 40 days or 150 days. Just so you know, there's this theory that there were two or even three flood accounts in different writings, and that an editor sort of conflated them to make a single account, which would explain all these contradictions in the Genesis flood story. By the way, I don't believe there are any contradictions in the Genesis flood story. So what about this? Well, how about maybe it rained for 40 days, but the time that the flood was up to a certain level was 150 days. All right? Makes sense? I mistakenly read chapter 8, verse 3 first, where it even kind of explains that. All you have to do, that's one of the points I want to make, is all you have to do is read a couple more verses. Hello, are you trying to read the Bible simply to find contradictions so you can publish them on your website? Or are you actually trying to find out, honestly, whether it's a contradiction? So fairly easily answered, simply because it rained for 40 days, but the flood lasted for 150 days. We recently had some pretty intense floods in North Carolina and also in Iowa. And the rain, let's say the rain lasts for 2 days, but the floods do not reach their peak for up to a week afterward. All right? And so this is not a contradiction at all. All right, Genesis 37, verse 36. And by the way, these are just samples. These are just samples. I could go on and on and on. That page that has 15 to choose from, I could go on and on and on. All right, Genesis 37, 36. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and the captain of the guards. So according to this passage, Joseph was sold to the Midianites. Then we go to Genesis 39, verse 1. Supposedly written by another author. And Genesis is a compilation of several different accounts with obvious contradictions. And the editors didn't get around to fixing all the contradictions. That's what people say. All right, so Genesis 39, verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken to Egypt. An Egyptian named Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites. So we got to get it straight here. Was he sold to the Midianites or was he sold to the Ishmaelites?
Sold by.
Well, two. All right, the Ishmaelites or the Midianites? And clearly, there's a historical error here. I mean, he could not have been sold to the Ishmaelites and the Midianites, obviously. Now, I have a question. Are you an American?
Yes.
Are you a Californian?
Yes.
You're confused. You don't know what you're talking about. You're on drugs or something like that. I'm, of course, picking on Pedro again. All right, because the fact is, the Midianites were Ishmaelites. An Ishmaelite is an Arab. And how many Arab tribes were there? In fact, the Amalekites were Ishmaelites, and the Midianites were Ishmaelites, and a bunch of other Girgashites and other things were Ishmaelites. A bunch of other ites. Again, people put this on their websites, and people go to these websites and go, there you go. All right, so we need to get out in front of some of this stuff. Matthew 27, verse 5. Okay, so he threw the silver into the sanctuary and departed. Then he went and hanged himself. So Judas hanged himself. But then in Acts, there's an obvious contradiction, so that Luke probably should have checked out his facts a little bit better. But then everybody knows Luke is full of stories and fables, and he's not reliable at all. And, you know, you shouldn't trust anything he says. Either that or Matthew. I don't know which. Acts 1:18, where it says, now this man acquired a field with his unrighteous wages and fell headfirst. He burst open in the middle and all of his insides spilled out. What a wonderful picture there. So we have to decide, which is it? Did he hang himself? Or did his body burst open when he fell? Well, how about, he hung himself. His body was up there for 2 or 3 days, bloated as anything. They cut the rope. His body fell, and it broke open. Now, this is sort of obvious, right? But these are the kinds of contradictions people claim are in the Bible. And they confidently declare to all of their friends, including, like, religion professors at San Diego State, as I can attest to, saying these kinds of things. And I'm just telling you, these are typical examples. Okay, John 19:17. I'm not going to bother to read these. John 19:17 says Jesus carried the cross to Golgotha. And Mark 15:21-23 says Simon the Cyrene carried the cross to Golgotha. Now, they couldn't both carry the cross to Golgotha, obviously. So John was just, he forgot, or maybe he just wasn't careful. Because obviously they couldn't both carry the cross to Golgotha. But why is that obvious? If I drove from here to, Albuquerque, it said John drove. And it says Jan drove. Well, how about John drove till he got tired and then Jan drove? Or how about Jesus had been beaten to the point nearly of death? By the way, the story we've heard is that he collapsed out of being completely tired. It doesn't actually say that. Now, that's kind of what we assume, but is that a reasonable assumption since he'd been beaten virtually to death? All right, so there's another contradiction. Now, those four are just plain not contradictions. They just simply are not contradictions. And people who say it are looking for excuses, in my opinion. This is my opinion. But let's look at an actual contradiction. 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 4. I'm telling you, it's an actual contradiction in the Bible. 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 4. No, it's not. No. Ah, see, he's been anticipating all week. No, this one has an obvious and easy explanation. I'm holding off on the one that doesn't have an obvious and easy explanation. All right, 2 Samuel 8, 4, which says, David captured 1,700... Let me see. Yeah. David captured 1,700 horsemen, 20,000 foot soldiers from him, and he hamstrung all the horses, and he kept 100 chariots. All right? Now, I'm not sure if your faith in God is depending on the number here. I'm not sure if your belief that God is in control is really going to be affected by the number of horsemen here, but let's go to the contradiction, which is in first. Maybe keep your finger in 2 Samuel, just in case we have to go back and cross-check to make sure that we're finding an error here. 1 Chronicles 18, verse 4. 1 Chronicles 18, verse 4. All right. So it says here, David captured 1,000 chariots, 7,000 horsemen, 20,000 foot soldiers from him, and hamstrung all the horses, and he kept 100 chariots. So the question is it 7,000 or 1,700? Now, that cannot be, you know, it's not like the Midianites and the Ishmaelites, and it's not like Jesus and Simon of Cyrene. Now, I would say, obviously, there's a copying error here. Have we already conceded that there are copying errors? In fact, like I said, when you're copying a text, when you're copying words, a misspelling jumps off the page, like horge instead of horse or something like that. But with numbers, unless you happen to already know the number, or if it's something obvious, you know, like, for example, it said the number of apostles, and it's... And you probably, if it said 26, you'd know that's probably a copying error. You'd fix it. But the fact is, there are a number of copying errors specifically in numbers. So the claim is that the Bible contradicts itself. But really, the question is whether the original text contradicted itself. And it's fairly obvious that whoever wrote 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles, either they both had the same source they were copying from, or possibly 1 Chronicles was using 2 Samuel. So the most reasonable explanation of this is simply the numbers 1,700 and 7,000, just a copying error. Yes?
So when they wrote down numbers, did they write the actual numbers, or did they spell out the numbers like they do here?
It was kind of like Roman numerals. Roman numerals, they use letters for numbers, which makes it even harder to copy correctly, especially because some of the Hebrew letters are very, very similar to each other. Yeah?
My Bible just doesn't show a difference at all.
Yeah, it doesn't
look the same. All right, fine. It may be that there are different manuscripts. And it's even possible that... I'm going to just guess, which is that there are different versions, say, in the Septuagint and the Masoretic, and possibly, say, the Masoretic might have attempted to make the accounts identical because a copying error had slipped in. Okay? All right, now here's another one. Luke 8, 26 through 39. Luke 8, 26 through 39. this one definitely could not be, I'd say certainly could not be a copying error. It's not likely. It's too important a detail that a copying error could have slipped in. Luke 8:26-39. I'm not going to read the whole thing. That's the account of the demoniac, the crazy guy. All right. So then they sailed to the region of the Gerasenes. And by the way, that was claimed to be an error because they said there is no such place as Gerasenes. There is a place that's got that name, but it's like several miles from the lake. And it turns out there is a place called Gerasenes that is a few miles from the lake. And there's also a place called Gadarene, which is right on the lake, like a very, very small community. And that's not a mistake, but that's just a side thing. There's so many of these out there. All right. Anyway, reading on here. When he got on land, a demon-possessed man from the town met him. For a long time, he had worn no clothes and did not stay in a house, blah, blah, blah. So this demoniac comes out and meets him. In Mark 5, verse 1 through 19, it also describes this demoniac coming out to meet Jesus. And then there's Matthew 8:28-34. When he had come to the other side, to the region of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men met him as he came out of the tombs. So, is it one or is it two? No, it's not both. It can't be both. In this case, it can't be both. It's two. It's two. And apparently one of them was the one who broke the chains and the one who was infamous and everybody's afraid of. And then there's this other demoniac, too, who's kind of, you know, he's there also. There's two of them. But one is like the one when he drove the demons out, the pigs went into the water, the one who went back, Jesus asked to go back. And then there's this other guy. In fact, I would say the fact that there are different details is not evidence of contradiction. What it's evidence of is we have two independent accounts. We have two independent accounts. And along these lines, you know, I've had the wonderful experience of being a juror in a few trials. And I remember the first one I did, it was this guy who stabbed his own sister a bunch of times. It's a terrible story. And but the details from the eyewitnesses were really quite different. One person said he went into the drawer and pulled out some other knives. And one person didn't even mention him going into the kitchen and all these other things. And even as we're listening afterwards, when we went back into the jury room, we all agreed, wow, at first it seemed like, man, the accounts were really different. But then when we sat down, we kind of went through it, kind of prepared a time, and we realized there were literally no contradictions. All right, different people noticed different facts. Different facts were significant to other people. We don't remember everything. We remember the things that were significant to us, etc. And we concluded that there was no significant difference. Well, there was differences, I'm sorry, but there was no conflict. And so many of these claims, especially in the Gospels, that there's all these contradictions, I believe it's simply not true. And we'll look at a few of those where it says that they went to the tomb and there was an angel. In other places it says they went to a tomb and there were two angels. And one will say that he said that the guy would be healed at the house. Another place he said he'd be healed on the way to the house. And all these things, when you think about it, if you try to just imagine probably what actually happened, something pops up right away and you realize, no, in fact, these are not contradictions. They're simply evidence that we have independent, separate accounts. If they agreed on all the details, that would be evidence of collusion. In fact, I'll tell you right now, when in my three trials, we had evidence that appeared to conflict in all three. In all three cases, they didn't. In all three cases, they complemented one another. But I'm telling you, if any of them had given the exact same account, what would I have assumed? They prepared it. All right? And so these supposed contradictions are simply the result of having four complementary accounts, I believe. Anyway, how about conflict of doctrine? This is another category. The people who threw out Genesis 7:17 and Genesis 8:3, in my opinion, they're just trying to make trouble. They don't even know what they're talking about. They don't even care, honestly. There might be some exceptions to that, but in general, and when Christians get thrown for a loop by this stuff, I kind of like, you know, just keep reading or think about. But things like Exodus 20, verse 4 through 5, that's something that I think is a reasonable question. All right, so Exodus 20, verses 4 through 5. So these would be proposed conflicts or contradictions that have to do with theology or doctrine or even commandments that could be in conflict. All right, so here we go. Do not make an idol for yourself. Genesis 20, verse 4. Do not make an idol for yourself, whether in the shape of anything in the heavens above or in the earth below, the waters under the earth. You must not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children of the for the father's sin to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. All right, so basically saying that the sin of the father will produce punishment to the children down to the fourth generation. And then we can read Ezekiel 18, which seems to contradict this. At least you could. It's certainly reasonable to propose this, as opposed to the other ones, which I think are not even very reasonable, to be honest with you. Ezekiel 18, 19 through 20. And it says, but you may ask, why doesn't the father suffer punishment? Why doesn't the son suffer punishment for the father's iniquity? Since the son has done what is just and right, careful observing all my statutes, he will certainly live. The person who sins is the one who will die. A son will not suffer punishment for the father's iniquity. Now, you can't blame somebody for finding a conflict here. All right? And yet, I believe there's no conflict at all. Because I believe in Exodus 20, he's talking about the consequences in this life. And the fact is, when we sin in this life, we bring suffering on ourselves and on those around us and our children and our grandchildren. In fact, to be honest with you, I don't even need to read Exodus 20, verse 4 and 5 to know that. All right? It's a fact. It's a moral law, and I believe a moral law as avoidable as the law of gravity, that if you sin, you bring suffering on yourself and on others. And our society has learned it goes to the second and to the third generation, especially physical and sexual abuse. All right? And anger. And that's not what God is talking about in Ezekiel 18. Ezekiel 18 is talking about eternal consequences. In fact, if you simply read Exodus 20 carefully, and if you simply read Exodus 18 carefully, you'll realize that in Exodus 18, he's talking about eternal consequences. There's no contradiction at all. Here's what I've learned, is when you see these supposed, and admittedly apparent, though, not just supposed, maybe I shouldn't even say supposed. I should maybe say apparent contradictions of theology or doctrine. What I've found is, in every case, it is not a contradiction. But when you understand how they're both true, you understand God more deeply. So let's look at another example. Another example would be Exodus 20, verse 8. It says, remember to dedicate the Sabbath day. Right? We got to keep the Sabbath. God wants, obviously the Jews, God wants the Jews to keep the Sabbath. All right? Clearly. Until you go to Isaiah chapter 1, verse 13, then you find you're all confused now. Okay, Isaiah 1:13. Where it says, stop bringing useless offerings. I despise your incense, new moons, and Sabbaths. And the calling of solemn assemblies. I cannot stand iniquity with a festival. I hate your new moons. God's saying, I hate your Sabbaths. Now, wait a minute, God, you got to help me out here. You either want us to observe the Sabbath or you don't. And what's the answer? Yes, he wanted them to observe the Sabbath, but they're going to have sin in their heart and blatant hypocrisy and iniquity and try to use the Sabbath to appease God as if they could appease God by buying him off. He hates it. It's not a contradiction. And yet, believe me, I've had people say clear contradiction. Now, here's another one. How about Ephesians 2, 8 through 9? Ephesians 2, 8 through 9. Well, we already know that one. I hope you know this one. Been a Christian for a while, you better know this one. All right. It says, for by grace you are saved through faith, and this not from yourselves, it is God's gift, not from works, so that no one could boast, for you are God's creation, created in Christ Jesus for good works. So we're saved by grace, not by works. All right? Great. You know where I'm going next, right? James 2:24. Now, we do not want to handle this the way Martin Luther did, which is by dismissing James 2:24. All right. It says, you see that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone. All right. Well, it says we're not justified by works. And here it says we are justified by works and not by faith alone. So how do we work that out? Now, one of the things that I've learned in trying to deal with these apparent contradictions of theology or doctrine, I've learned to ask, which is the more fundamental truth? In fact, let's apply that to the first one. Which is the more fundamental truth, Exodus 20 or Ezekiel 18? No, which is the more fundamental truth?
The one about God not judging us on based on other
things. Right. Ezekiel 18 is the more fundamental truth. That is what God is about. The fundamental truth is that God is just, and we are not held accountable for what somebody else does. I believe that's the more fundamental truth. And then we look at Exodus 20 and understand it in that light. So how about Ephesians 2 and James 2? Which is the more fundamental truth, that we're saved by faith, not by works, or we're not saved by faith alone, without works? Which is the more fundamental truth? Saved by grace through faith, not by works. We are not saved by works. No work could ever save us. That's the more fundamental truth. And the secondary truth is faith that doesn't include works is not even faith at all. But, you know, just so you know, okay?
But, yeah. John, can you argue that faith includes works? I mean, that's...
Well, the biblical definition of saving faith includes works, yes. But the works don't save you. It's the faith that saves you, okay? Got it? Now, here's a funny one. Let's go to Proverbs 26:4. Proverbs 26, verse 4. Don't answer a fool according to his folly, or you'll be like him yourself. Awesome. And then, verse 5. Answer a fool according to his foolishness, or he'll become wise in his own eyes. Okay, so which is it? Now, first of all, it's Proverbs, all right? Proverbs is not doctrine. It's certainly not theology. It's advice. And the fact is, sometimes getting involved in the fool's discussion makes you a fool. But sometimes, when you simply repeat back to the fool what he just said, the fool will go, yeah, that is foolish. So it depends. So which should you obey? First of all, this is not a commandment, right? It's just wisdom. No contradiction. All right. David, here's another kind. I like that one. That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay, good. David took 700 men or 7,000? Which is it? Exodus 20, verse 8, I already talked about that one. Okay, more difficult ones. There we go. We've already done that. All right, these are, like that. Okay. Now, here are some others. I'm near the end of my list, by the way, and then we'll do our fun ones. People say Matthew 2, let's go to Matthew 2:23. And these are examples of people claiming that there's a contradiction in the Bible. And these are people who simply just don't know the Bible. In this case, you know, when I hear people criticizing Matthew 2:23, I admit that if you don't know the Bible, I don't think that necessarily means it's an insincere person. Some of these claims of contradiction, I believe, are coming from people who are just looking for dirt, have no interest in whether it's true. They're just trying to destroy people's faith, and why bother with careful research there? I mean, you know, just start throwing mud. But I admit that unless you know the Bible fairly well, Matthew 2:23 might seem to be problematic. In fact, there are claims that four or five of the prophecies that Matthew quotes as prophecies, he's totally taking out of context, and they're not even prophecies. All right. Well, I disagree with that. I strongly disagree with that in every case. I've looked at these carefully, and I believe this is simply because the person saying that doesn't understand Matthew, what Matthew's trying to do, that Matthew is arguing prophecy as prefigure and foreshadow, not just literal historical prophecy. They simply don't understand the Old Testament or the relationship between the Old and the New Testament the way Matthew does. But anyway, Matthew 2:23 says here, then he went and settled in a town called Nazareth to fulfill what was written, spoken about through the prophets, that he would be called the Nazarene. Where's that? Where's the prophecy that he'll be called the Nazarene? And so Matthew's trying to make it look like Jesus fulfilled the prophecies, so he's making up a prophecy that didn't even exist. Well, that's not true, because Isaiah 11, 1 through 2, and in Zechariah 6, 9 through 15, the Messiah is called Branch. And he's the branch of Jesse. The Messiah is called Branch three or four times in the Old Testament. And the word branch is Nazar. So basically, Nazareth means house of branch, essentially. So Jesus was born literally in Branch. In other words, the Nazarene. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Lived. Thank you. He lived in Branch, and he was literally the branch. Now, not only was he literally the branch of Jesse, he was figuratively the branch of Jesse, because Jesse's son was David, and he is the son of David. This is not a contradiction. This is just somebody who doesn't understand the Old Testament. All right, and then there's the claim that there are two different genealogies. And you have to admit that somebody reading Luke and Matthew, you can't blame them for. In fact, I'm guessing even Christians find this confusing, certainly. I'm not going to go to those, but essentially it turns out that Matthew is the genealogy of Joseph and Luke is the genealogy of Mary. All right? And so in Luke, when it says the father of Mary, it's the father-in-law of Mary. And there are cultural reasons why Luke, whose audience was primarily Greek, would have done this. And what's interesting is apparently Jesus is the descendant of David, both through his mother and through his father. And if you understand the purpose of Luke, to bring in the role of women. If you look at Luke's genealogy, he mentions the women that are kind of involved and the whole thing about these outcast women that the society would consider not important, Rahab and Ruth and Mary. It all fits the theme of exactly what Luke is doing. It is not a contradiction. What about the fact that there's 28 generations in one, and there's a different number of generations. It's because we know for a fact that when Jews listed genealogies, they didn't list every single person. They would skip sometimes 5 or even 10 generations. So when they say he lies the son of Mathat or whatever, that means he's the direct male descendant. There's simply no contradiction. There just isn't. Another one, in Matthew 1:23, Matthew is quoting the Old Testament, and he says the virgin will be with child. And yet he's quoting from Isaiah chapter 7 or 9, I can't remember. Either way, 7 or 9, it doesn't matter. It doesn't say that the virgin will be with child. It says the maiden or the young woman will be with child. So Matthew is purposefully misquoting the Old Testament in order to make a point, in order to create a case that obviously Jesus wasn't even born of a virgin, and he's just trying to trump up that thing by misquoting the Old Testament. Well, that's simply not true. Now, it is true that the word in the Old Testament in Isaiah, I might as well get it right, Isaiah 9:14, basically says young woman. What is it?
7:14.
Thank you. So in Isaiah 7:14, it does say young woman. But it also says God will give a sign. A young woman will be with child. Now, if a young woman who was married or had had sex with somebody gave birth to a child, would that be a sign? No. So what's the natural interpretation of that? That it would be a virgin birth. In fact, the Septuagint translation, which was made 250 years before Jesus was born, translated it into the Greek word, unambiguously, virgin. So is Matthew abusing the Old Testament to make a point? No. He's just essentially quoting the Septuagint, which was the Jewish understanding that it was a prophecy about a virgin, which is the natural interpretation of the verse anyway, not a contradiction. Go ahead.
So he's writing in Greek and quoting the Greek.
Well, I don't know for a fact that he's quoting the Septuagint. He probably is. It wouldn't matter. Because the person who created the Septuagint was reading the Hebrew and interpreting it as virgin. So whether Matthew was doing what the producer of the Septuagint was doing, or whether he's quoting the Septuagint, it doesn't matter. This is not a contradiction, and it's not Matthew manipulating the facts. It just isn't. And after a while, when you start to look at these claimed contradictions, you start kind of going, these claims are proving the Bible's inspired. These people's attempts to prove the Bible is not inspired are, in fact, proving the Bible's inspired. All right, Matthew 2:15. There's a whole bunch of these right in a row. And Jan's giving me the time signal. Thank you, Jan. I'm going to keep going for a few minutes, but I do appreciate the time signal. Matthew 2:15, because it apparently is close to 10 o'clock. Time to take a break. Matthew 2:15. Nevertheless, I'm going to do this one. All right, he stayed there until Herod's death, so that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, out of Egypt I called my son. And the claim is this is totally taken out of context. In fact, if you go to Hosea 11, verse 1, he's not talking, it's not even a messianic prophecy. It is true. It is true. Hosea 11, 1 is not a messianic prophecy in the same sense of riding into Jerusalem on a donkey or 30 pieces of silver. What it is, it's a foreshadow. And the fact is, out of Egypt, God called his son Israel. Out of Egypt, God called his son Moses. Out of Egypt, God calls us, because Egypt figuratively is a life of sin. Out of Egypt, God called Jesus, literally. All right. And so basically what he's saying is that Jesus is fulfilling the messianic expectation of people being called out of Egypt. And he calls us out of Egypt as he was called out of Egypt. Not a contradiction. All right, now let's do the worst contradiction of all time. Then we'll take our break. Okay, Matthew 10:10. Matthew 10:10 says here, don't take a traveling bag for the road or an extra shirt, sandals, or walking stick, for the worker is worth his food. Okay? So do not take a walking stick. Got it? And then Mark, and by the, also Luke 9, by the way. Mark 6. Mark 6. All right. He instructed them to take nothing for the road except a walking stick. Now, that's not a copying error. I'm sure that's not a copying error. In fact, if you had two different versions, one that did say bring one and one that didn't, for Mark, you'd figure that the one that contradicted would be the correct one because somebody's trying to fix it. So here's my question. Did Jesus ask them to bring a walking stick or not? Well, what did he actually say in the first one? Don't bring an extra walking stick. Right. Don't bring extra food. Don't bring an extra cloak. In other words, in both cases, he's saying, go on faith. In both cases, he's saying the same thing. Go on faith. I'm telling you, that is the hardest to answer contradiction in the Bible, in my opinion. All right? So let's take Jan's advice and take a 5-minute break. And then we'll do our little thing where we do our own little answering the contradiction. I'll put them up on the screen in case you want to pick ahead of time. And then there's the Tell Dan inscription. All right? In which this guy, let's see, Hazael says, I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of the house of David. And this is from 820 BC. So what does this tell me? Well, David was a real person. Not only was David a real person, who lived around 1050 BC. Here it is 230 years later, and succession of kings was still in place, the children of David. Not only that, we have evidence that there is the southern kingdom, and there is the northern kingdom. And we can find the details about this. It's in 2 Kings chapter 8, 28 and 29. Now, what's interesting, in 2 Kings, it says that that it wasn't Hazael who killed Jehoram. Actually, it was Jehu. In fact, in the account in 2 Kings, it says that that Jehoram was wounded in the battle, but not killed. And later on, he was actually killed by Jehu. Now, here's my question. Just common sense question, throw out anything like assuming the Bible is inspired. Based on what you know so far, which is the more believable account? That he was killed by Hazael, or that he was wounded by Hazael and later killed by Jehu? Which is the more believable account? Wounded and killed. Yeah, it's just common sense. He thought he killed him, he wounded him. And he was dead shortly after, so he just assumed he killed him. In every case, when we have external evidence, the Bible's evidence for its reliability is very, very strong. Now, one interesting thing is there are no statues of kings or of any important political figure in Israel from this entire time. None. Why is that? Right, because God said not to do it. All right, so that's why there's a paltry amount of actual, you know, like you have carvings of Julius Caesar or, Octavius or whatever, or Augustus. But here we go. This is King, I believe it's Jehu, right? Yes, this is King Jehu bowing down to Shalmaneser. Here is King Jehu. This is an actual one of the northern kings, Jehu, bowing down to Shalmaneser. We know so because of the inscription that gives their names. So you know what? I think Jehu was a real person. And I think when it says that the Assyrians conquered them and they paid tribute. By the way, what it says in the Bible is that they were conquered by Shalmaneser and they paid tribute. It doesn't mention him going actually to wherever it would be, probably Nineveh or Nimrud. But that's sort of cool. And then there's the Sennacherib cylinder. That's kind of nice. Now, you know the story in 2 Kings 18 where Sennacherib came and he conquered all. The Assyrians had already wiped out the northern kingdom. Now he's conquering the entire southern kingdom, all the cities in the southern kingdom. He surrounds the city. This is when Hezekiah had the very, very long tunnel built to the water source there. And according to the Old Testament, what happened is surrounded the city, a massive army, and one night the angel came and destroyed the entire army. Well, you would think maybe there'd be a record of that. Well, actually, there sort of is, because here's what it says. I'm going to read a slightly longer account. This is on the Sennacherib cylinder, which it's in the British Museum. It's only this big. It looks huge, but it's really just this big. It's smaller than you think. Anyway. As to Hezekiah the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to the countless small villages in their vicinity. I drove out of them 200,000 people, young and old, male, female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, big and small, cattle beyond counting, and considered them booty. Himself I made a prisoner in Jerusalem as royal residence, like a bird in a cage. End of story. Why does the story end there? Because he lost that battle. His army was defeated. Because all ancient histories are a litany of victory, victory, victory. These guys never had a single defeat. And it's interesting. What he describes exactly corresponds to the Bible, but it ends right at the point where it gets kind of embarrassing for him. Because the fact is, his army was destroyed. The largest army, the most powerful king at the time, the siege ended, and there you go. All right, and then there's the Siloam inscription, which in 2 Kings it talks about building this tunnel to the pool, and the tunnel's been found. Here's the inscription, and it says, in the seventh year, in the month of Kislev, the king of Babylonia, this is the story of the boring through, and it's an account of when they met from both sides, as described. There's the Babylonian Chronicles. There's the Lachish letter, the Babylonian Chronicles, which describes the war that happened in 597 BC, details of a lot of overlap. The Bible describes the destruction of Lachish by the Assyrians. This was found in Nimrud. All these bas-relief carvings of the same exact events. This is interesting. This is one of the Lachish letters. If you read in Jeremiah 30, let's read. I know, Jan, I'm over time. I'm going to go 5 minutes over. Jeremiah 36, verse 6 and 7. Because this is just too awesome stuff. Jeremiah 34, verse 6 and 7. It says here, so Jeremiah the prophet related all these words to Zedekiah the king of Judah in Jerusalem, while the king of Babylon's army was attacking Jerusalem and all of Judah's remaining cities against Lachish and Azekah, for they were the only ones left among Judah's fortified cities. And later on it mentions that Ezekiah and Lachish were destroyed. Now one of the sharks, this is found right at the gate in the city of Lachish, and it says the light in Ezekiah just went out. If you don't send troops immediately, we will be destroyed as well. And it's perfectly aligning with the biblical account. In fact, the person who wrote this letter probably died within maybe a couple of days. So again, the not only the fact that Jerusalem was destroyed, but even the fact that the last two holdouts were Azekah and Lachish. And this guy says, Azekah, the light just went out. So that's pretty cool. There's the Babylonian Chronicles. This is interesting because in 2 Kings, it mentions that when Jehoiakim was taken to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, he treated him really well. And he gave him provisions till the end of his life. And this is pretty amazing. But in the destruction of Babylon, they found this inscription. It's a clay tablet. And it lists the provisions given to Jehoiachin. And he was given 10 times as much provisions as all the other people on the list. Oh, that's kind of cool. This is my last one. All right. We're going back to the Ziggurat and Ur, because in Daniel chapter 5, it says that Belshazzar offered the third highest place in the kingdom to anyone who would read the writing on the wall. And what's interesting is the critics of the Bible until the 1970s said there was no such person as Belshazzar. Everybody knows the last king was Nabonidus. Herodotus said the last king was Nabonidus. All other sources said the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. Nabonidus isn't even mentioned in Daniel. Instead, we have this guy Belshazzar that nobody ever heard of. And then in the Ziggurat and Ur, they found an inscription which explains what was going on here, because Nabonidus had a palace coup. He was illegitimate king, but he killed evil Merodach. He took the throne, and he married the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. And he had a son whose name, of course, was Belshazzar. And Belshazzar was legitimate heir to the throne because he was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Anyway, what happened was Nabonidus was not legitimate ruler, so he left his son as a regent ruler, and his son was sort of essentially ruling, but he was technically a regent. So when you go to Daniel 5, when it says that Belshazzar gave the third place in the kingdom, well, why did he offer the third place in the kingdom? Because he had the second place in the kingdom. He did, in fact, rule as king, but he was had the second place in the kingdom. And in the case of Daniel, people want to say that Daniel was written around 160 or 150 BC because of the amazing prophecies in there. But the problem with that is that we know for a fact that all historians at that time had never even heard of this guy, Belshazzar. But Daniel, the writer of Daniel, heard about him, and he even said that he would take the third place in the kingdom. All right, so in summary then, we won't talk about the Cyrus cylinder and the fact that actually probably Pontius Pilate was a real person and they really did crucify and there really was a pool of Siloam and Caiaphas was a real person and yes, they did make a gift called Corban and yes, Sergius Paulus was a real person and they did call the people from Thessalonica Politarchs and Gallio really was a proconsul there and et cetera and Erastus really was, et cetera, et cetera. All right, good. So my conclusion is the Bible is the most reliable source of history from the ancient world, which is further evidence that it's inspired by God. Thank you for coming for 5 weeks and let me talk an extra 7 minutes. I have to go home and re-record this.